Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we'll begin with budget guru Stan Collender. He's going to bring us up to date on Republican efforts to replace Obamacare and other shenanigans on Capitol Hill. Then we'll speak with Whitney Castle. Whitney is a counterterrorism expert, and she says that despite all of his tough guy bluster, Donald Trump is actually increasing the risk of terrorism against the United States. And finally, we'll be joined by George Polisner. He was one of thousands of ordinary people who were moved to action by the 2016 election. Unlike most, he gave up a good job to launch a new grassroots startup. We'll get the details on that later in the show. And with all of that going on, we're not going to have time for our usual introduction. I encourage you to go over to like Right Wing Watch or Media Matters and make fun of some wing nuts on your own time. We're going to take a quick break and then jump right in. Stay tuned. Show. I'm always pleased to have Stan Collender. Stan is known as the budget guy. He's an executive vice president at Corvus Group and a columnist for Forbes. Stan, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you. It's always good to be here.
So for the past two days, we've been playing this game on Capitol Hill. It's called Find the Republican Healthcare Plan. The GOP announced this week that they're putting the final touches on a plan to repeal and or replace the ACA. It's not clear if they're going to do the replacing before they do the repealing. But they said that only Republicans could see the plan before it's ready for a vote. And the irony here is that one of the big lies that Republicans have deployed against the ACA was that it was drafted secretly and behind closed doors without any Republican input. But let's set that aside. Several congressional Republicans seem to have a hard time finding this bill. Stan, you spent many years on the Hill. What do you make of all of this? Have you seen something like this before?
No, it's... Going back to 1974, when we kind of did more government in the sunshine, and the freshman Democrats that year insisted that committee hearings be open and things like that, I've never seen anything like this. And we're talking about 43 years later, where even the Republicans won't show their own members the bill, and you have to go into you can't make a copy of it, you can't read it unless you're in a locked room where no one else is allowed. This is not legislating. This is some bastardization of that you've got to believe that it's not being done out of confidence. It's being done because they're so worried about what happens when the details get out.
So that's the thing. The root of this, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that they don't want to see the CBO, that's the Congressional Budget Office, score their plan. Is that what it's all about?
Well, not just that. I mean, I think the politics of healthcare reform is becoming so difficult. Remember, Donald Trump said this past week that who knew that healthcare reform was this hard?
Yes.
But I think what they're finding, what he meant was not so much the details, the technicalities of the bill, but the politics. And it's not so much that CBO and the scoring is going to get out. That will happen eventually. It has to. But it's that different factions within the Republican Party are going to find out that there are parts of this they can't stomach and they're going to kill it before it goes on. They're just trying to, that is, the leadership is trying to get a little momentum here before it stops completely.
And there was word this week that they were thinking about doing a repeal plan. And the idea was that they would put an enormous amount of pressure on, let's say, hesitant members. Having campaigned for years on repealing the ACA, they would have to then vote for repeal, and then they would rely on Democrats to help them put together a replacement plan. Is this something that you think is a viable strategy for them?
Yeah, it sounds like wishful thinking, almost desperately wishful thinking. It's fairly clear that the Democrats are not going to help the Republican majority out on this. I mean, they're just not. And if they break it, that is, if they repeal the healthy ACA without having a repeal in place, they, being the Republicans, are going to have to take the full brunt of the anger that's coming out on this, and the Democrats are just not going to help them. So, you know, they may be thinking they're dealing with the Democratic Party of 5 years ago, where they were desperate to get something in place. If the Republicans repeal this, the Democrats are going to say, it's yours, you have to own the issue. And we've already seen the level of anger that's come out at the town hall meetings, or the pseudo town hall meetings, or the lack of town hall meetings. This is going to get much, much worse when you have not potential victims of ACA repeal, but actual victims of people who are going to be denied health care, some of whom are going to die and we're going to have their kids die. It's going to get really ugly very quickly.
You wrote that repealing the ACA was supposed to be a slam dunk. That's what they said. They would come in and would do it on day one. And I'm going to quote you. You wrote, "The controversy between and among congressional Republicans is now so multifaceted, heated, and chaotic that the delay could soon make it far more difficult for the House and Senate to deal with both ACA and tax reform." So what you're saying is that the ACA brouhaha is overflowing into other areas where the Republicans would like to move their agenda. They were supposed to be able to do an infrastructure plan, tax reform, all this stuff was supposed to happen right away. Is this ultimately a cost that they're willing to pay? And are we running off the clock? Like, do we see that there's... Tell us about the budgetary process in terms of the length of time that it takes to do things.
Sure. Now, first of all, I'm not sure I would use the word brouhaha, but you did, so let's go with that. The Republican plan was actually brilliantly crafted and conceived. Because they only had 52 votes in the Senate, they needed to use reconciliation. That's part of the budget process that prevents a filibuster. So they would only need their 52, even 51 votes, even 50 if Vice President Mike Pence voted to break the tie, to actually get either ACA repeal and tax reform in place. So the strategy was simple, and again, brilliant. They would do one budget resolution in January for 2017, and would do reconciliation from that, and that would be ACA repeal. And then when that was finished, which we all thought they would do very quickly, they would turn to the 2018 budget and then do another reconciliation process off of that that would do tax reform. The problem is that the strategy turned out to be too clever by at least half, if not more. That is, it relied on doing the reconciliation from 2017, the ACA repeal, quickly. Because it all becomes moot. Once the next budget resolution, 2018, is considered in May or June of this year, the 2017 process to do away with ACA becomes null and void. So if they don't get health care done quickly, they may not be able to get it done at all, or are going to have to jump through all kinds of hoops or break all kinds of precedents or get the parliamentarian in the Senate to rule in ways that she's never ruled before. So it's going to get very messy, very quickly, very ugly, and very politically difficult. It could threaten the ability to do tax reform later in the year, and it certainly is already threatening the ability to repeal ACA, the Obamacare. So, you know, one of the things the Republicans never thought of is, do we actually have the votes here? Do we have enough unanimity? And I'm surprised. I was shocked, because my assumption was they'd pass a budget early in January, which they did, but then pass ACA repeal in time to send it to President Trump so that he could sign it from the podium on Inauguration Day. They didn't do that, and now we're months behind schedule.
And as we say, they are really at odds on how to go about it. There is this so-called suicide caucus within the Republican in the House, about 80 members who are from deep, deep red districts. They're less concerned about the party's national political fortunes than their own political fortunes in, again, these deep red districts. And they're saying that they won't accept anything that maintains coverage for tens of millions of people. So they've really put themselves between a rock and a hard place. Let's shift gears just a little bit. I remember that the big lie in the early aughts, and this was repeated across the entire conservative universe, was that George W. Bush's tax cuts, these huge budget-busting tax cuts skewed towards the wealthy, would pay for themselves by unleashing a torrent of economic growth. We heard this from George W. Bush, from Dick Cheney, from conservative pundits, et cetera, et cetera. 2 weeks ago, you wrote a piece titled "Trump's Very Dark Budget Black Magic Began Last Week." Are we seeing a case of deja vu all over again?
Oh, all of the tricks from the George W. administration. Yeah, in fact, even all the tricks from the Reagan administration are going to come back in spades here for this administration. They've already indicated that they're going to have what we used to call rosy scenario. That is, assume that the economy is going to perform much better than expected, so more people will be working, companies will be paying more in taxes because they're earning more. So that's one way they're going to keep, at least on paper, the deficit down. But there's almost certainly they're going to use other things like dynamic scoring, which has never really been proved to the extent that they want to use it. They may go back to the Reagan-era magic asterisk, and they may just simply do the equivalent of denying the laws of economics. They're already saying that they think that they can increase productivity, almost double it. And I don't know any economist, any reputable economist on either side of the aisle, or liberal or conservative, that thinks that's possible. So the president's promising things, and his budget may show things that just aren't doable. It'll give him a chance to put it out there, and make it look like he's accomplishing something that no one else could accomplish, but it's really not going to happen.
And this is kind of related. A couple of weeks ago, the Wall Street Journal reported that the regime was considering a change in how the trade deficit is calculated. This is, It's about how goods that come into the country and then are immediately shipped elsewhere are calculated. Right now, they're counted as both imports because they come in and exports because they immediately go out. The Trump team was considering counting them only as imports, and this would make the trade deficit look a lot bigger than it is. Stan, what is behind this?
Well, I mean, part of it is just wanting to control the narrative. That is, if the trade deficit looks bigger, the president, his people will be able to say that we're not being treated fairly by our trading partners. That we've got to impose some sort of tariff or tax on imported goods because we're getting killed overseas. But the bigger issue here is, why do they think that they're just free to change all the rules, to change the things that economists and analysts have been following for years? Now, just because it doesn't suit their purposes, they want to change, or because the older numbers don't suit their purposes, they want to just change them. It's the height of of arrogance to think that you can go in because you're president of the United States and change facts, change substantive material that would be different than the way we've done it for maybe 100 years.
Now, there was a revolt against this by wonks, I guess you could say, including conservative wonks. There was, I was listening to NPR, there was a guy from the Heritage Foundation who was very much against this. He said it was a clear case of cooking the books, making statistics mislead the public. Should we be encouraged by that pushback?
Yes, to a certain extent. And we should all, and in fact, some of the bigger excesses of the administration have been pulled back, or proposed bigger excesses have been pulled back, simply because of negative reaction. They were issued as trial balloons. This was one of them. It was either leaked permanent person, intentionally or unintentionally. But some of the pushback has been great. But I got to tell you that I have no doubt that congressional Republicans in particular aren't going to hesitate to change the rules or apply the rules differently than they've ever been applied before, if that's the only way they can get their agenda in place. There's an old saying that Democrats play by the rules, Republicans play to win. That seems to me what's going on. I mean, there may be some of the bigger excesses will be curbed, but there'll be other changes, and the administration is showing that clearly, They have a tendency to change things when they need to suit their own purposes.
And we've seen, I think it's been very clear that congressional oversight is a non-starter as long as Republicans are holding the gavel. Finally, Donald Trump insists that we don't spend enough on the military. And I mean, this is kind of bizarre given that we spend more than the next six countries combined. Also, given that our immediate national security threats appear to be less state-to-state big battlefield conflicts and more special operations forces, et cetera, et cetera. And he says, well, we don't have as many ships as we had during World War II, which is correct. And we also don't have as many horses as we had during the War of 1812, because, you know, our military is highly advanced, and a modern warship, of course, packs the same firepower as, I don't know, dozens of World War II vessels. Anyway, he wants to significantly increase military spending and take the money out of social safety net programs. This is putting him at odds with congressional Republicans who want to cut so-called entitlements like Social Security and Medicare to pay for tax cuts. Missing in all of this is the so-called sequester, the funding caps on defense and non-defense spending. You wrote recently that Trump might have to break the law to pass his budget. What is going on here, Stan?
Well, it's really simple. Look, in some sense, it makes sense. That is, you want to increase military spending. You want to do it without increasing the deficit. You would cut other spending to offset it or increase revenues. And from a calculus kind of point of view, that makes a great deal of sense. But the law, as we've put it in place, the Budget Control Act that was passed in 2011, doesn't allow that to happen. You've got two pots of money, military and domestic. And there are caps, there are limits on the amount you can spend in each one. The law specifically says if you want to increase more in defense, Congress has to vote to raise the cap so you can do that. You cannot cut domestic spending. You can cut domestic spending, but it can't be used to offset the increase in military. If you did spend more than the cap in military, then you trigger this automatic across-the-board cut called a sequester. And this goes back to something we just talked about. My strong assumption is that if Congress can't or won't increase the cap on defense spending, which they won't, then what the president may very well do is tell Congress, go ahead and appropriate more for defense. I'm not going to apply the law. I'm not going to implement the sequester law, as it's required. He's taken an oath of office to implement the laws under the Constitution, but there's no way to stop him from ordering OMB Director Mulvaney from not implementing the law. That's what I think is actually going to happen.
So let me get this straight. So Congress can pass legislation eliminating the cap on defense spending, but that could be filibustered, right?
Right, exactly right. And the Democrats would likely do that if they didn't get a concomitant increase in domestic spending, which the Republicans wouldn't agree to. That's why I said I don't think that increase in the cap is doable or passable.
So you're saying that he's just going to tell the Office of Management and Budget to blow off the cap? And is there any recourse? Does anybody have standing to bring that to court?
Well, I've asked that question a lot from a bunch of lawyers. And as far as I can tell, no one would actually have standing to sue. You don't sue the president. You'd sue the OMB director for not enforcing the law. But it's not clear that anybody could say that they were damaged enough to have standing to sue, in which case there'd be no penalty for the president breaking the law.
There you have it, folks. No penalty for the president breaking the law. Stan Collender, I believe we are out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back. Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Whitney Castle. She's a foreign policy analyst and a contributor to Foreign Policy Magazine. She spent 4 years at the DOD working on special operations, counterterrorism, and issues related to Pakistan. Whitney, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Ryan Leza wrote a piece at the New Yorker last month detailing how Donald Trump might be able to seize additional powers in the case of a major terror attack. It was a kind of eye-opening piece. This is a guy who, of course, ran on getting tough on terror. He accused the Obama administration of being soft, of letting terrorism proliferate. But it's been a tumultuous first 6 weeks, to say the very least. Whitney wrote a piece last month at Foreign Policy titled Trump's First Casualty is U.S. Counterterrorism. Listeners can check that out at foreignpolicy.com. Whitney, can you lay out your thesis for us?
Sure. I mean, the thing that's sort of interesting about, as you said, you know, Trump's claims to be tough on terrorism or sort of wanting to ramp up counterterrorism operations is that his actions in these first 6 weeks have actually been very much to the contrary, or are unlikely to actually achieve those ends. And the thesis in the article is that the travel ban specifically, that, you know, banned travelers from 7 Muslim majority countries and put the Syrian refugee and refugee programs at large on hold indefinitely, actually does quite a bit to stymie U.S. counterterrorism efforts abroad, specifically in Muslim countries where we really require the cooperation and assistance of the host governments in order to be able to operate. So places like Yemen, Pakistan, Afghanistan, to some extent, although we do have much broader authorities there, Iraq to some extent, and elsewhere, those are countries where our counterterrorism operations are fully dependent on those host governments, not only allowing us to operate on the ground, but also cooperating to give us the intelligence that we need to go after Al-Qaeda or ISIS or whoever the bad guys may be. We just don't have the kind of infrastructure abroad to be able to get the information we need to know where to go and who to go after without having partners in those local intelligence services. So by alienating essentially the entire Muslim world, he's really, I think, undermining our ability to conduct those types of operations.
And of course, we need to keep in mind that there have been 0 Americans killed by terrorists from those 7 countries. So on the one hand, it is a solution in search of a problem. On the other hand, it is creating a problem. How difficult has it been in the post-9/11 era to build the kind of relationships with Muslim majority countries that you're talking about, as you write about, and how important has it been in terms of the fight against terrorism? Have these relationships yielded demonstrable fruit?
I think it's been extremely difficult, but I think we have seen some success, and a lot of that success, I think, is the result of our government and our armed forces in some cases being really willing to sort of put out a hand and kind of get over the type of anti-Islamic, you know, fears that the Trump administration is sort of playing on and really get down to business and convince these folks that it's in their interest to work with us. So, you know, every country is different. The of course, and the example that I'm the most familiar with is the Pakistan one, which is, of course, is a famously fraught relationship where we had to work extremely hard to convince the Pakistanis to work with us. And any kind of blip on the screen or, you know, a public statement or something that was perceived by them as anti-Islam or anti-Pakistan for whatever reason would be a real setback. So while I'm not on the ground now, obviously, and I don't know the details of the relationship, which are probably classified in most cases, I can only imagine how that travel ban announcement would have played out on the ground. You know, you really do have to sort of build trust with your counterparts and be able to work with, you know, in the Pakistan example, you know, the Pakistan Special Forces, the Frontier Corps, and the other Pakistani military units that the U.S. Special Forces presence there has historically worked with. You know, those guys are extremely suspicious of the United States and are extremely suspicious of our motives. So anything we do to feed into that perception that we are afraid or that we hate Islam or that we're at war with Islam is really going to undercut that. To the extent that we've had success, I mean, I think we have when you look at the number of Al-Qaeda operatives that have been killed in Pakistan, assuming that that's sort of your metric for success, which in counterterrorism generally is, whether you think that, you know, the ends justify the means in those types of operations is a separate conversation. But I do think that a lot of that success, if you want to call it that, is very much dependent, in the Pakistan case, also on cooperation with Pakistani intelligence services.
In your article, you focus on Muslim-majority countries, but it's been widely reported that there are simmering tensions between U.S. intelligence and our Western allies. There's a lot of suspicion about Trump's alleged ties with Russia. Do you think that these relationships are the type that run on autopilot regardless of who is in the White House? Or do you think that there is also a sense that these Western security alliances are also being undermined by Trump's rhetoric, which has alienated a lot of our allies?
I don't think that any relationship runs on autopilot, frankly, at least not for very long. And I think that if I were a European nation that was directly threatened by Russian military aggression or potential Russian military aggression, whether it's, you know, the Poles or the Estonians or even some of the Scandinavian countries, I would be concerned about a perceived kind of special interest or some kind of compromise on behalf of the U.S. administration in sharing intelligence with us. I mean, I do think that the gap between the president and sort of the day-to-day intelligence sharing that goes on between American and European partners is pretty large. So,
yeah.
You know, it's unlikely that something that the Estonians are going to, you know, give us is somehow going to end up on the president's desk and, you know, being leaked to the Russians. It's sort of, you'd have to make quite a few leaps there. But
right.
I, if I were the Estonians, for example, I would find that very worrisome to think that I'm sharing information with a country that is suddenly being compromised at the very top.
Now, there's another angle here, which you don't discuss in the article, and that is recruitment. I tend to think that it's a bit simplistic to think that some ordinary person is going to read about Trump's travel ban and think, okay, that's it. I'm joining ISIS. I'm going to give up the family farm. But there is a larger dynamic at play. Islamic extremists do hold this view that there is a clash of civilizations between East and West. They posit that the West is at war with Islam. This is integral to their recruiting message. To what degree do you think Trump and his inner circle reinforce those claims? To what degree do you think that they help this recruitment effort?
I mean, it's hard, while I agree with you that no one's probably selling the farm just based on this one development, I think it's hard to imagine that it doesn't feed into that type of radicalization in a lot of parts of the world. You know, there's always going to be people who are sort of on the edge. Maybe we're willing to give, you know, the U.S. the benefit of the doubt, or, you know, see Islamic communities that are thriving and successful in the U.S. and think, okay, clearly these people aren't actually at war with Islam. I think it absolutely feeds into that rhetoric. It's hard to see how it wouldn't. And while I don't know that we'll see the results of that, you know, immediately or directly, I can't see how it wouldn't, you know, kind of undergird those arguments.
And we need to understand that that Trump has surrounded himself with some very wacky Islamophobic nutjobs, Sebastian Gorka. He is a kind of a fake national security expert and someone who has really ratcheted up the rhetoric about Islam. In his address to Congress this week, Donald Trump said that the raid that he'd ordered in Yemen was a rousing success. It's been widely reported that they went in with insufficient planning and inadequate intelligence. It was, I think, by any reasonable standard, a complete disaster. The high-level Al-Qaeda operative that they targeted got away. Later, he went on social media and mocked Trump. Reportedly, 30 civilians were killed, including 14 children, one of whom was a U.S. citizen. You talked a little bit about Yemen in your piece. To what degree do you think that raid really undermined our efforts to fight terrorism in Yemen and elsewhere?
Well, I, you know, the day after the my article came out, the Yemenis actually announced that they were no longer going to allow the U.S. military to conduct raids on Yemeni soil. So I think, you know, the details of the operation itself aside, that's a pretty major problem and a pretty major negative outcome, even if they were able to gather useful intelligence in the course of the raid. And I obviously don't know whether or not that's the case or if that's just what they're saying. And I do trust that Secretary Mattis would have been honest with the president if he believed that it had been, you know, unsuccessful or that they hadn't gotten useful intelligence out of it. But having that number of civilian casualties is always, obviously, a horrific outcome. And then having our ability to operate in a critical counterterrorism country, you know, compromised as a result of that outcome, I think is a major problem. And that in itself, I think, makes the raid unsuccessful. And if you go back to sort of the McChrystal Doctrine and all of the operational guidance that was given in Afghanistan, you know, every civilian casualty, you know, creates X number of new terrorists. So when you're, you know, killing that many civilians, you're compromising your relationship with the Yemeni government, you're compromising your ability to act in that country, and you're creating a really powerful recruitment tool for Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State.
And I should note that Trump claimed that General Mattis told him that they had gotten a lot of useful intelligence, but Reuters reported a number of senior officials, unnamed officials, I should add, contradicted that claim and said that there was no useful intelligence taken away from that. This is a he said, she said thing. Again, sure. They used unnamed sources. Let me ask you this before I let you go. You've worked in government. You've worked in the national security community. We just got a second national security advisor, H.R. McMaster. He's supposed to be an independent thinker, but and this is key, he doesn't have a full staff. There are also staff shortages at state. There are dozens of positions requiring Senate confirmation that Trump hasn't even nominated anyone for. I should say dozens in the national security sector. There are hundreds of overall. And I don't want to inflate the threat of terrorism. We should note that in the United States, you have a better chance of being, I don't know, shot by a toddler than
Definitely.
Being killed in a terror attack. But having said that, to what degree does the overall chaos in D.C. and in this White House and the kind of interagency uncertainties that it's created, do you think that undermines our national security?
I think it absolutely does. I mean, I worry that if there were to be not only a terrorist attack, but any kind of real national security emergency right now, there are not enough qualified people in the U.S. government to be able to formulate and execute a responsible response. And that goes for anything from, you know, Russian aggression in Eastern Europe to a terrorist attack to some kind of incident with the Chinese in the South China Sea. It does not appear to me, from the outside at least, that there are enough grown-ups in the room. You know, it's nice to have people like H.R. McMaster, who's extremely well-respected and obviously very, very smart. You know, someone like Secretary Mattis, pardon me. but, you know, those few individuals do not a government bureaucracy make. You know, and they can't execute a response to a crisis without those lower, and when I say lower, I mean we're talking about undersecretary and assistant secretary level positions. You know, these are very senior, very critical posts that remain unfilled. You know, I know that Secretary Mattis has requested or would like to appoint Ambassador Ann Patterson to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy position. She's an extremely qualified, extremely well-respected diplomat. She was the ambassador to Pakistan when I was in Islamabad, and that's being blocked because of you know, some of her work in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood government at the time that she was the ambassador there. So, you know, really kind of silly reasons why qualified people are not getting into the positions they need to be in. And I think it's really dangerous and short-sighted.
Folks, we've lost a lot of institutional knowledge at this point, and maybe it's a lesson that you shouldn't elect a reality TV star to serve as the president of the United States. It's a crazy idea, but just something to throw out there.
Right.
Whitney Castle, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this week. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and then be right back. Welcome back to the show. The 2016 election shook up a lot of people. It has spawned a new wave of activism on the left and given birth to a new generation of activists. I've been writing about the resistance for the nation, and I keep hearing these stories over and over again. I'll talk to people who started a new grassroots group or have gotten involved for the first time, and they'll say, you know, I was never engaged in politics until now. Or I was engaged to the point where I would read about it, but I never thought that I would be taking the point on this new effort to do this or that. And I just keep hearing this same story. My next guest is one of these people, and he put his money where his mouth is. George Posner is the founder of CivWorks. That's civ.works. And it's a new endeavor bringing together social media and political activism. George, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me, Joshua. And I've been a big fan of yours. As a matter of fact, I think during the RNC debates, the only way I could actually watch them or listen to them were through your tweets. So I greatly appreciate the work that you do.
Well, that's very kind of you, George. So you had a good gig with Oracle, which is a zillion-dollar tech firm, and you resigned from that job in a very public way in the wake of Trump's election. Tell us a little bit about that decision.
Sure. I had been at Oracle for quite some time. It was really my technology home since 1993, although I did a couple of tours of duty with Oracle. I was in and out. But essentially, when our co-CEO, Safra Katz, decided that she was going to go to work for the Trump transition team and did not take any kind of leave of absence from Oracle, and also issued the statement, we're here for you in any way, and we're here to help you in any way that we can, that pretty much did it for me. I, having Oracle, my years at Oracle and knowing Oracle's roots as a database company and with the Trump administration talking about a Muslim registry, I felt that it was important to, and I recognize too, Joshua, that I was at a point in my life and career, my kids are pretty independent. You know, I've been able to get my living expenses down. And so I wanted to really drive a powerful statement. And so I, as opposed to just doing a quiet resignation and slithering off and doing something else, I did it very publicly on LinkedIn, and then was pretty surprised at the result. It gained a great deal of attention, far more than I had expected.
Your former colleagues at Oracle, how do you think that they saw this move by the company to embrace Trumpism? How did it fit or clash with the culture, the company's kind of corporate culture?
You know, it's interesting to me that I think that Safra really made an uncharacteristic mistake by not communicating much internally. And this took me by surprise, and I think it took many people by surprise. And on the LinkedIn platform where I posted my resignation, there was a thread of public comments and quite a few, I think a few thousand comments. And they were about 50-50. Some were very supportive and some weren't. But a lot of the private comments that I received, and many of them from my former peers at Oracle, were very supportive and really were deeply concerned about this move. And Oracle is a global company. It, you know, it is a zillion-dollar company for sure, but it's global. And I have worked with and for Muslims at Oracle, and I think that there is, you know, great concern in terms of Oracle, you know, being more political, or at least, you know, certainly a co-CEO engaging actively is cause for concern.
So you decide to throw yourself into this new project, CivWorks. Why do we need another social media site, and how will it differ from like Facebook?
You know, that's we're hoping that we need another social media site. I had been working on the concept with a couple of really incredibly bright people for a while in the background. And we always had something of a time and money problem. We were all working, doing other things. And on December 19th, I, of course, solved my time problem. And so we started dedicating, at least I started dedicating myself to the CivWorks effort. And the reason, important reasons behind CivWorks is that, and I'm sure you're aware of some of the stories about Cambridge Analytica. Steve Bannon is on their board. Robert Mercer, I think, provided a great deal of funding to evaluate people's data on Facebook, their profile information, who their friends and connections were, and how they were using Facebook, the things that they liked, the things that they commented on. And so all of that data was analyzed and effectively used against people. It was used to drive propaganda, fake news, to cause people to vote against their self-interest, as well as to self-disenfranchise or disengage from the political process, because they were getting reinforced with messages that, you know, both parties are inherently corrupt, so why vote, and things like that. And so CivWorks, the thought of CivWorks is twofold. One is it's a privacy-protected social network, and so we're run by a nonprofit. We don't sell anyone's data to marketers, so that's a benefit. You won't be, if your water heater breaks and you tweet something about it, you won't suddenly be getting ads from Home Depot, through CivWorks. But more importantly, the data is not going to fall in the hands of some sinister data analytics company looking to elect the next, Donald Trump.
But it's more than just a site where your data is secure, right? You see this as a kind of an incubator for political action. Is that right?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, we consider the social platform to be the gateway drug for civic engagement. And what we're doing, and we're getting ready to release some fairly powerful technology. And the other thing that's interesting, Joshua, is we really didn't want this to just be another tech-driven platform. And so we're using a lot of behavioral and organizing theory to really help. But what we're doing is related to, we know that we're going to be assailed. Society is going to be assailed across all of the issues, whether it be environment, women's rights, LGBTQ, gun violence prevention, healthcare. And behind every one of those issues, we know that there are several advocacy organizations. And so the average person is going to get subjected to, an explosion of emails competing for somebody's attention with respect to sign this petition, donate this money. And there are a lot of great organizations that are working on this stuff, but what we wanted to behaviorally prevent is overwhelming people and having them just check out of the process because, fundamentally, people still are trying to live their lives through this horrific political landscape that we've managed to create for ourselves. And so a lot of our thinking is to essentially use the social platform, aggregate actions across all of these different organizations so that what we present to a CivWorks subscriber, social user, is, hey, you care about public education. This is, you have issue affinity for public education. At 3 p.m. tomorrow, there is a meeting of school board candidates at your library. So what we want to do is we want to relate very specific actions based upon issue affinity as well as a subscriber's location so that people can take action at a local level, a regional level, as well as a national level. And so that's something that's very, very powerful and important that we're releasing a little bit later this month.
So that's not, is that going to be something that a human curates or is it going to be algorithm based?
It's going to be both because the actions themselves will be doing two things. One is we'll be scraping the internet to look for actions coming from organizations like Moms Rising and the ACLU and others that are all important actions. And we also will have people that are acting as action curators that are entering the information, reviewing the quality of information to make sure that these are valid actions. And then in the back end, the machine will essentially be looking for equivalent actions to merge them together. So, we're not hitting a user with 20 of the same thing. We're putting out a little bit at a time in terms of the highest priority actions that somebody could essentially engage and perform. And then we're supporting them by providing a civic engagement dashboard. And so you will be able to see over time, individuals will be able to see, their engagement activity as well as, something of a feedback loop in terms of what happened where the information is available with each action.
And what gap did you see in the existing universe of political infrastructure that you were saying, this is something we can fill? I mean, is this a... Can we think of this as like a response to the decline in unionization? There was a time when you would get political education and a certain amount of affinity, social affinity, through your membership in a union or a Shriners Club or whatever. Is that something that you were trying to recreate here?
It's part of it, but actually it goes well beyond that. And the reason is, and I wrote a paper about how progressives organize. And the problem is we tend to be heavily siloed, and we still are. And so labor, you know, a lot of different organizations certainly are interested in the same societal outcomes. But we seem to be very passionate and advocate within our narrow silos. That, I think, is very harmful for us. We end up essentially not necessarily sharing the way that we should and not acting together as we should. And so the thought behind CivWorks is, how can we take these silos, whether it be labor, environmentalists, women's organizations, LGBTQ community, you know, gun violence prevention, healthcare, how can we take all of these different and very, very important communities and issues provide a platform where they can continue to have local autonomy. They continue to work on the things that are absolutely important to them, but now there's an opportunity for all of us to engage rapidly together so we can create something of a societal flash mob using a platform like CivWorks when we really need to. We can use the platform to not only protect and defend, which is going to be incredibly important over the next couple of years, although we don't want to necessarily protect and defend Jeff Sessions, we'd rather see him indicted.
Yes.
But anyways, we want to protect and defend society, but we also want to be strategic. And so we recognize that at a certain point, if we're successful, it's not all going to be reacting to attacks on societal issues. We need to basically have a well thought out, cohesive agenda moving forward. And we need to have all of these siloed communities working together to cooperatively drive progressive infrastructure and progressive policy.
Now, George, there are a couple of things that make it a challenge, I think, for this kind of project to take off. First, you're charging $4 a month to participate. That's not a lot of money, certainly, but I think it's historically been tough to get people to pay for a service that they can get for free or that they perceive to be like something they can get for free. And then it's also invitation only. What makes you confident that you'll get enough people signed up to make this a vibrant community?
Do I seem confident at all, Joshua? So essentially, those are two great points. And what I believe is that, first of all, I'm very concerned about a digital divide, and the last thing that we want to do is create an economic barrier. And so, you know, $4.99 a month is not a huge economic barrier. I find the bigger barrier is getting somebody to basically perform an online transaction. Because if somebody takes their credit card out, they're not going to say, well, the service is great at $1.99, but it's really too expensive at $3.99, right? So there's
So
it's not necessarily an economic barrier. It's really more of an online transaction barrier. We are free to the EDU community as well as some nonprofit organizations. And the reason that we wanted to do that is we felt that a great place to really begin a lot of very important civic engagement and civic participation discussions were on college campuses. So we are doing everything that we can, but at the end of the day, we've got to cover our costs, and we, you know, hope at some point in time to be able to take some small salaries so I don't have to run this out of my 14-year-old Prius. So I think that you're right, we do have issues to overcome, but also people's privacy is worth something. You could see that every time there are changes to the privacy policy on Facebook, everybody screams and says, I'm done with Facebook, I'm getting out, but there just hasn't been a real viable alternative. And so I am hopeful that we get people coming through two doors. One are people that are very sensitive to their data not being sold to sinister organizations. And the other are people that, you know, really do want to help us build something, you know, incredibly important. And so, you know, that $3.99 that people pay, you know, some of that is value from the platform, but some of it is also, these are people that want to build something, you know, really important infrastructure together. And so I think of the CivWorks community and the subscribers to CivWorks as really being people interested in building some very important infrastructure that that society really hasn't had. I mean, all the most important infrastructure that we've had emanated from the Lewis Powell memo, and it's all conservative infrastructure. And so it's time that, you know, that society, that we, the 99%, built something that can really, truly work for us and help us, you know, get some sustained momentum in these political cycles, so we're not fighting tooth and nail every time, that we're winning and people are voting aligned with their self-interest. And invite-only thing, so we wanted to start out slowly, right, because we're a nonprofit and we didn't know whether we needed to go out and buy Amazon for their data centers. And we recognized that we even if we wanted to, we probably couldn't do a leverage buyout. And so it helps us at least initially control our growth. But I think that the invite-only, don't tell anybody, this is a secret, but I think the invite-only is probably going to go away by the end of this month.
Folks, you can also go to CivWorks and request an invite right now. It's at civ.works. George Polisner, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I really do appreciate it.
Well, I greatly appreciate you, Joshua. Thanks for all that you're doing, and keep up the great work.
I'd also like to thank Stan Collender and Whitney Castle. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. And you can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. I would also like to thank the good people at Hullabaloo and Crooks and Liars and the Smirking Chimp for allowing me to host the show at their joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.